If you can't describe what you're doing as a process, you don't know what you're doing. And I would honestly, not to be too provocative, challenge many schools to describe what they're doing as a process. Once you understand that our purpose is conceptual transfer and you begin to work with a school on a set of transfer goals, suddenly everything begins to fall into place. To me, feeling inspires action, not academic cognitive understanding. You know, we all know what should happen in the world. Why don't we do it? We don't care enough. That's an emotion.
Hello and welcome to the Coconut Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Benjamin Freud, and today's guest is Kevin Bartlett. Kevin is the founder of the Common Ground Collaborative. He's held leadership positions in the UK, Tanzania, Namibia, Austria, and Belgium, where he was most recently director of the International School of Brussels from 2001 to 2015. Kevin has co-designed accreditation systems for European Council of International Schools, the Council of International Schools, and NEASC. And he's currently engaged with a small team developing ACE, A-C-E, an innovative new accreditation protocol for NEASC. Kevin is a regular author of articles on a range of topics, a keynote workshop leader at multiple international and national conferences, and on-site consultant on a wide range of topics. He's a writer and trainer in the field of curriculum design and leadership for learning for the Principals Training Center. As a curriculum designer, he was the initiator and early leader of the IB Primary Years Program, the PYP. I'm very excited to share this conversation with you. Kevin's not only the founder of the IBPYP, but he's also someone whose journey in leadership, education, and learning has moved along. And he talks about this throughout this conversation, how his thinking has changed. And yet there are certain points on which he has found himself and works with conviction, but not a conviction of close-mindedness, but rather open-mindedness. And I particularly appreciate how this conversation makes me think of resistance to the traditional, resistance to conformity, but not in a way that's violent resistance or not in a way that's just anti-establishment, although that could be okay too when it comes to conformity, but rather asking the right questions, that criticality, the wondering why we are where we are today and might there be different ways to do things that are better and lead to a more thriving world. Check us out, www.coconut-thinking.com. That's www.coconut-thinking.com. And in the meantime, I will leave space for my conversation with Kevin. Well, hi, Kevin. It's a real pleasure to get to know you. I know you and I share a friendship with Thinga and interest in that space. And I've been following your work on LinkedIn. Just really wanted to get a sense of really where your thinking is and maybe also how your thinking has evolved over the past, I don't know, little while, years, who knows. But I'll start off with the question that we ask all our guests, which is, who are you and what story do you want to tell?
Well, thanks, Benjamin. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. It's fun to just to unpack ideas with other learning geeks. If I had to label myself, it would be professional irritant, maybe, or obsessive puzzler of learning dilemmas. And so 50 years a teacher, still embed myself in schools and never ask teachers to do anything I'm not prepared to do myself and be videoed doing it so they can see it being modeled. So teacher for 50 years, leader for 40, led 4 different schools, all highlights, but maybe the most recent highlights would be going to Namibia to be the first recruited director of Windhoek International School shortly after Namibia got its independence from apartheid. So took a big salary cut from Vienna and went to bring international education to apartheid, basically. And then from there, International of Brussels, where the Common Ground Collaborative was founded, and so was Next Frontier Inclusion, helping a great school become a more inclusive school. We had a simple mission, everyone included, everyone challenged, everyone successful, and I think we pulled it off. So apart from a school leader, I have been obsessive about trying to systematize international education. Why can't it make more sense? Why isn't it more systemic? How can we help teachers, kids, families move between schools more smoothly? So that prompted me to found the IBPYP. Actually, it was kicked off of something called the International Schools Curriculum Project. We literally gave the intellectual property to the IB, and it became the IBPYP. And then a subsequent rethink of the same goal, really, to create one simple, single, synthesized learning continuum pre-K through 12. And that became the Common Ground Collaborative. So I guess I'm a systems thinker, storyteller myself. I teach a lot through telling stories. My own story then is 40 years of leadership, driven by the same two or three questions. What is learning? What are schools for? What's our learning purpose? And how do we take rhetoric and make it reality? How do we go from the webinar to the workplace? How do we go from the conference to the classroom? How do we beat the problem of transfer? Because things, sadly, don't really transfer easily. So, yeah, that's my story. Educator for life, teacher for life, leader for 40 years, and a systems finder, pattern finder, trying to find useful systems to help other people run schools in more effective ways, help more kids, help more parents. So it's that obsession with, you know, I think we could do this better. I guess I could also describe myself as the kid standing on the street in the Emperor's New Clothes story, who puts his hand up and says, "Excuse me, why are we doing it like this?" So I guess I'm that guy. I'm the "why are we doing it like this" guy, and I've been that guy for a long time.
I used to ask the question, how do you define learning? And then I realized or appreciated that to define means to make something definite. But as learners, we're always changing things. So how we conceptualize and approach learning changes, and there can't be any definite there. So now I ask the question, what does learning mean to you?
Well, ironically, to put that, your own thought back to you, we decided if we were going to systematize learning, then we had to approach it systemically. I'm a big believer in inquiry. So we actually created the CGC learning ecosystem driven by just five questions. And the first one was, what is learning? And we actually did define it. What we defined, Benjamin, and my wife pointed this out to me when she looked at our work. She said, you know, what you've actually defined is the learning process. So here's where we ended up in terms of learning. We said, our real goal is to create learning experts. We want kids who can make sense of the world and help the world make more sense. So what do experts do? And we reached the conclusion that experts, and you used the word yourself a minute ago, experts are experts in the ideas of their field and how they relate to each other. Experts are highly skilled in their field. And we sure as hell need expert human beings with greater empathy and compassion and kindness and resilience. So we ended up with this very simple and now sort of iconic learning definition within the Common Ground Collaborative of learning is the process of the consolidation and extension of conceptual understanding, competency, and character. And even though everything evolves, and it does evolve, I'm a big believer in convergent evolution when I look at the coming together of Jay McTighe's work with my own work, for example. I think some things can be constant, Benjamin. And I think becoming, as we say with the children we work with, good with ideas, good with skills, and good people, seems to me it holds up fairly constantly. Now, how we build those ideas and our pedagogical awareness and our skill set, that evolves. But I think it's reasonable to say that we can hold to something fairly constant if we say we want kids to be good with ideas, good with skills, and good people. A final thought on that. I'm an admirer of the work of W. Edwards Deming, who transformed Japanese industry after the Second World War. And he said, and I love the pithiness and in-your-faceness of this, he said, if you can't describe what you're doing as a process, you don't know what you're doing. And I would honestly, not to be too provocative, challenge many schools to describe what they're doing as a process. Within CGC, we said that's the process of learning. We actually created a pedagogy around each of those three C's. And that, because it's simple, I'm always looking for simplicity, because it's relatively simple means it's pretty scalable and I can teach it to teachers whose own pedagogical background may have not at all been in that kind of constructivist, progressive stream of learning. People who traditionally stood up in front and simply delivered information. If you say, let's think of it like this, let's connect to the kids' prior knowledge. Let's construct new meaning on top of that knowledge and then share it. So we use connect, construct, contribute. So simple process definition of the absolute essence of learning turned into simple process definitions of the essence of teaching and therefore planning and therefore assessing. So I guess learning means to me That process of building deep conceptual understanding of ideas that matter, high levels of competency and key skills, strong positive moral character. And my challenge is to make that happen in every classroom with which I'm involved.
And the question I'm going to throw is the idea of context, because when you think about the systematization of education, if we are in Brussels or if we're in Panama or if we're in Vietnam or Japan, the context changes. And we talk about the prior knowledge and meaning. That changes with context, the spaces that are around us. It changes with time, who we are at a certain point. How can we systematize this idea of learning in the schools while at the same time taking into account the context that will play a significant part in the learning process?
Yeah, it's absolutely essential, Benjamin. So the schools we work in talk about the three C's, the ones I've just been talking about, but they're absolutely worthless out of context. So if we add a couple more C's, content, you can't teach learning in a vacuum. And that content, what's worth learning in Vietnam is not what's worth learning in Utah. So content changes, the whole context of the school changes, and critically, the other crucial C, the culture changes. So what we've been trying to do is find replicable processes where the questions you have to answer are pretty constant, but your answers will vary according to context. So for example, I don't actually think, I talk a lot about curriculum, but I actually see our work as building culture first, and then community. And then in that context, in the context of one school's culture and community, you can build a curriculum. And I think if we're going to do things well, I think we need to be more intentional. So many of the things I talk about, we kind of know. When I'm in a room full of people on Zoom or in the flesh, I'll always say, and I'll mean it, all the knowledge we need is in the room. But what we're not good at, I think, Benjamin, in our profession, and other professions aren't either, other industries aren't either, is intentionally making implicit knowledge of a community, the employees, the clients, whatever, actionable, making it go from implicit to explicit so that we can actually use it. So we have a very intentional, explicit way of building a culture with a school. So we just say, so what makes a culture? And I think there's a pretty universal agreement that cultures share common language, for example, common aspirations, common values, common norms, common celebrations, common history, common location. So by asking certain questions, that I think the questions are somewhat constant, the context will provide its own answers. And it's always that, what can be constant, what will vary? What is loose? What is tight? And I think the vehicle to bridge across context is the question, the language form of the question. Rather than coming and say, well, you need to do this, you say, so what's worth learning? What's worth learning in Madagascar right now for these kids? That answer might be different if I'm in Chicago. But the question is still valid. So we build learning systems through a process of what we call fearless inquiry. The context and the culture are everything. But I think you can ask those questions in any context.
I appreciate what you mentioned about this action, and specifically not just in terms of inquiry, just for the sake of inquiring, but actually transforming that into something. And I'm wondering, what is it about the possibility of taking action and making it accessible, and more to the point, maybe the impact of that action, something that we can assess? And I guess my thought is going at, we can take on a project and take a question and do something with it, but how do we make sure that that action starts to have legs, starts to be alive, starts to go and permeate and cascade throughout other parts of the community, so that it's not just something that comes for us, but something that we share together, or something that we do for good, is something that you mentioned as well. It's a long way of asking, where do we go beyond action in order to make sure and to understand how we can benefit the community?
Well, that's a multi-layered question. And every layer is a good layer. One thing to say is I love to learn, and I love to work with people who are smarter than I am and learn from them. So just to tell a quick story, a few years ago, I was asked to co-author a new accreditation protocol for the New England Association of Schools and Colleges. I have huge respect for that organization, along with others like UCIS. Really smart people, really committed to improving learning. So I worked with Peter Mott, who was working for NIESC at the time, and a guy called Greg Curtis, who actually wrote Leading Modern Learning with Jay McTighe. What I learned from Greg was impact, output, input. The difference between an impact, which is the actual change we want to see, the assessable, observable shift in behavior. Output is a process, a product, really, that might get us there. Input is the actions we might take to have that product. Not to go on too much of a tangent, but I think it's relevant in terms of your question. Schools make plans to turn ideas into action. When I look at most of those plans, they're often very complicated. They've often been supported by a consultant, and not to be unkind to consultants, sometimes very expensive consultants. But when I look at some of those plans, they tend to focus on outputs. By next year, in 5 years' time, we will have this and this, and we'll have a makerspace. We'll have a new policy manual. We have this and this. And like you, I suspect, I would suggest that that can be an entirely worthless exercise. Because what really counts is the impact. If I take boards, I work quite a lot with boards, but in very different ways. I came not to believe in traditional board training. So a board might have a goal. We need a new policy manual. Why do we need a new policy manual? That was what the accreditors told us. So they put a team together, and they spend a year, they have a new policy manual, and they tick the box, goal achieved. And then you say, is it making any difference? And people say, what do you mean? Well, is it making any difference? Oh, we don't know. We didn't really design for the difference. To me, the purpose of a policy manual would be something like, in like circumstances, boards behave fairly and consistently in response to difficult decisions, something like that. That's the only point of the policy manual, is that the board follows consistently certain beliefs and values, and it acts that way. And then it's only worth assessing to the impact. It doesn't matter ticking the box that we have a policy manual if every decision the board makes is totally random and follows no consistent process. So I'm an absolute believer in turning ideas into plans. You know, what's the old saying? A goal without a plan is just a wish. We always plan for impact and only then plan for outputs and inputs. I like to use, I'm always looking for simplicity. So when we plan for action, Benjamin, our protocol, and I think people can probably picture this, first column is impact. Where do we want to be? Next column is evidence. How will we know when we get there? Next column is the inquiry. What questions will guide us there? Next question, the reality. Jim Collins, face the brutal facts. Where are we now? And only then the action. What, when, who. So I think steering schools always towards impact and evidence of impact before we ever look at what we're actually going to do is one part of an answer to your multi-layered question. I think another part is to recognize that it's only a culture if everybody buys in. So all I can say is we work very directly, but very differently with parents and with students to convey the biggest ideas that we're working with, which you and I will get to in this conversation, I'm sure, because a lot of what I'm now focused on is what we're calling transfer goals, conceptual transfer goals. So I think by focusing in the end in mind, and let's unpack that as we're talking, focusing on impact, keeping it simple, don't try to do too many things, involve everybody, be ruthless, face the brutal facts, you actually make a cultural shift towards, we're actually doing this now. We are actually doing this now. And you just have to keep asking yourselves, are we really doing this? So what is another really good question that comes in handy very frequently. So multiple approaches, but in the end, quite simple. Focus on impact. Don't do too many things at once. We go with collective impact goals. I'm not a big believer in asking every teacher to write their long list of personal goals every year. We can be fairly facetious with that. We call that letters to Santa Claus. You know, every year the teacher is asked to sit and write their list of their letters to Santa of what they're going to achieve this year. And they send it off to the North Pole and nobody gets back to them and nothing happens. And next year, whoa, it's Christmas time again, letters to Santa time. collective impact goals that answer the simple question, if we could only do one thing next year, what thing would have the biggest positive learning impact on most students? Why don't we just do that? And let's involve the kids, let's involve the parents. So simplicity, impact, collective action, and ruthless so-whatting contribute to making a dream into an actual reality.
Within all this, within the question of all this, is asking ourselves, who are we? Who do we want to become? What do we want to become? Because the impact might be different in terms of the values that we might have. Sometimes we might want to prepare our learners for a certain direction. Other times we might want to do another direction. Sometimes something else is at the core of who we are. How do we start to navigate as a school in terms of identifying who we are? And I ask this because, you mentioned international education. I look on any international school site and you could take a vision and mission and kind of, switch it around and nobody would tell the difference. How do we get to that place as an international school where there's so much movement, about 20%, turnover? How do we get to that place where we build that culture of knowing who we are so that we can understand the impact that we want to have?
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it, Benjamin? One thing to say is we work a lot with independent schools. We work a lot in bilingual, often quite conservative, Catholic schools in Latin America, for example. I'm based in a school in Panama because my wife and I always do long-term residencies to prove our point. So I have a meeting on Monday with 140 faculty and staff at Academia Internacional, Academia Interamericana de Panama. And we'll be asking all those questions. We've set a vision from three good schools to one great school. But to get to the absolute heart of the question, and this has been my 50-year painful discovery of the blindingly obvious, I would now say with absolute confidence, I'm just wondering whether I'll change my mind in a few years' time, but I don't think so, that the question you ask of who we are, what our identity is, and what are we trying to achieve? What's the purpose of education? What's the purpose of our school? And I would now say the purpose of our school focuses on transfer goals. We need to send kids out. I've said this already, I think, in this session, to make sense of the world and help the world make sense. Facts and information don't transfer. A very good person in this field, there are lots, but Julie Stern's work is really outstanding, I think. She's really helping schools understand that our purpose is conceptual transfer. Once you understand that our purpose is conceptual transfer and you begin to work with a school on a set of transfer goals, suddenly everything begins to fall into place. It's almost like a pyramid. Sitting at the top, what we call, and I'll unpack it a little with you, a portrait of a learner. Schools customize that. It can depend on their mascot, which is fine by me. That's part of culture. In Honduras, portrait of a bulldog or portrait of a winged lion or in some schools, portrait of a learner. We describe those using the same three C's in our own model. We have six human capacities that we strive to develop. For example, a rational problem solver, a balanced person. And then we have transdisciplinary transfer goals. A rational problem solver can independently finish the paragraph. A rational problem solver understands that. And for each of those understandings, we try to keep it to a limit of three, not to overwhelm schools. Understands that, this, and this, and therefore, if then kind of thinking, is able to. So from conceptual to competency, and in so doing is becoming more kind, fair, compassionate, for example. So the three C's turned into very, very clear, accessible learning goals. Everything consistent, the ideas, the skills, the character. Good with ideas, good with skills, good people. Understands that, is able to, becomes more. And then what we're doing, and this is fascinating work, you should come over and join us sometime, portrait of a teacher or a portrait of a professional. If we want our kids to look like this, what do we have to look like? We're working with a set of parents in Panama. My wife gave a presentation to the PTA. They absolutely loved the portrait. They said immediately, we're now going to write the portrait of a parent. We're working closely now with EDI, Educational Design International, an old friend of mine, Prakash Nair. He built the high school in Brussels when I was head of the school there. A portrait of the third teacher, the Malaguzzi idea, the Reggio idea. What does the environment look like that creates a balanced person, a rational problem solver, an innovative creator, a compelling communicator, a respectful relationship builder, a contributing citizen? Those are our six capacities. How do we assess to those? Well, don't have too many things to assess to. What is, and you'll be familiar with this, what is truly transformative, and it's very new, but it's going to change and is already changing everything, and you know it already, is AI. So I've been working with Jay McTighe on the idea of what he calls curriculum mapping 3.0. His dream has always been, and he's been saying it for years, a curriculum map that's actually built on assessment tasks. Because if you spiral assessment tasks throughout the child's career, you know what they can do at every stage of that career. So we're now trying to build those assessment frames into our learning modules. We went at it from more design, from the front end, what's worth learning, what are the goals going to be. The other day, I took one of our transfer goals, rational problem solver. I took one of the competencies and I plugged it into AI as a prompt. You know what I'm going to say. The outcome was remarkable. In 30 seconds, it was a high school assessment task that would oblige the kids to provide evidence of their own learning against a simple description of a problem-solving process. What it came up with was actually a town design in a nutshell. In Good to Great, and I just think that's a wonderful book, I think many people kind of live by that, there's a chapter called Technology Accelerators. And Jim Collins said, technology won't tell you where to go, but when you know where to go, it will get you there faster. It's never been more true. Jay McTighe sent me about 3-4 months ago an email with the subject heading Game Changer, and he'd done the same thing. He'd taken some of our transfer goals and just plugged in a prompt to get an assessment task. It was better than, I work with some very smart teachers. Give me a bunch of teachers for a week, lock the door. We'll come out with a couple of good performance assessment tasks. Plug it into AI, you get something of probably superior quality in about a minute. Well, that is an amazing technology accelerator. So as the CGC works on a complete learning matrix, driven backwards from clear, accessible, transferable goals that we call the portrait of a learner, and then we assess to that, and we can design good performance assessment tasks and their accompanying rubrics in a matter of minutes, that is a total game changer. So I guess what we're seeing, Benjamin, is if it's about conceptual transfer, and if we can describe transdisciplinary and disciplinary transfer goals with their embedded conceptual understanding, driving a competency, building character, and if we can design assessments for those in a matter of minutes, that is an entirely new educational system in the making. And just to make the point, I kick off many, many workshops with lots of why stuff. One is, I call it lines of inquiry. So we put leaders in two lines facing each other just to have a conversation with one person. We ask a prompt question, a provocation. First one is, what are schools for? Then we change partners and we ask, why lead? And then we change partners and we ask, why should anyone be led by you? Etc. I don't think any of us as educators would say, oh, schools are for high stakes, low level testing so that kids can sit down and prove that they've mastered some of the least useful things in the world. Nobody would actually say that's what we do, but it's what we do. I'm exaggerating for effect. Most people, I think, would say, yeah, we give kids, they take away with them transportable intergenerational gifts. They go out to make sense of the world. They have great conceptual understanding of the world. But that's not what we assess for. So it's another of these knowing doing gaps. I think we know what we want to do, but we do something completely different. All we're saying is, well, if we know that's what we want to do, how about we do that then? So a lot of my own work, and I think Jay's work, and Jay's a super, he's a brilliant man, but in the end, he asks a few simple questions. Our assessment system is designed on 5 simple principles. And all I ever feel I'm doing is saying, well, wouldn't this make sense? Some people call this the common sense collaborative. Define the transfer goals in accessible ways, design the curriculum to achieve them, and embed in that curriculum the assessments that will give kids the chance to provide evidence of their own learning towards those final transfer goals. Provide the systems. Choose your portfolio system. I shouldn't mention brand names. There are a couple of great ones out there. Push the evidence onus back to the students. Very, very difficult for a hardworking high school teacher with 125 kids to assess every kid according to a set of great principles and provide regular, we call it STAR feedback, specific, timely, actionable, respectful feedback to all those kids. But build a culture of feedback where that's part of classroom time and kids are giving each other feedback. You break the back of these seemingly unbeatable challenges. But you need clarity, and the clarity comes from shared, clear goals. By the end of this module, the kids will understand that, be able to become more. By the end of their time with us, they will understand that, be able to become more. Teach to that, assess to that. John Hattie's work, teacher clarity, collective teacher efficacy, both have a massive impact on student learning. So honestly, the work we're doing, what Jay and I is doing, is informed by people like John Hattie, Jim Collins, and all of them preach clarity and simplicity. So clear transfer goals, systems built to achieve those transfer goals, including assessment systems, everything in balance, everything connected, voila. And if it was simple as that, everyone would be doing it tomorrow. But of course, putting into practice is complicated. But if you can provide clarity of direction, collective clarity to a whole community, and parents do embrace the portrait of a learner because it's so concrete for them. Do I want my kid to look like this? Damn right I do. What can I do to help? As opposed to, what are you doing in that school all day? So culture, community, context, embedded in that, the learning system, driven backwards by clear, valuable, life-worthy, to use a Dave Perkins term, life-worthy transfer goals, everything built to achieve them. I guess that's my personal vision at this stage in my life.
So I'm going to probably play a little bit of a devil's advocate or provide some resistance to this idea of clarity. And that is the risk that clarity might be confused with standardization. So we are clear that we all do one thing. We're all clear that this is what we must do. But there's a certain messiness in providing space for learners to provide evidence that makes sense to them. So the artifacts of learning might be completely different. Just off the top of my head, you might design a stack of game cards, and I might design, I don't know, a new baseball cap. I'm just coming up with the silliest examples possible, but it is possible that we have different kinds of artifacts. So we have to work with a kind of equivalence in terms of the assessment, even though the artifacts themselves might be different. There could be clarity in terms of what might represent quality or mastery. Maybe mastery is not the right word, but at least a certain amount of fluency in those transferable skills, content, knowledge, everything, the concepts. But how do we work with equivalency in a way that's clear when we have artifacts of learning that might look different?
That is a great question, and it's a difficult thing to do. But a friend of mine who founded IPC, Martin Skelton from Fieldwork International, brilliant guy, he would call that the good struggle. I think that's the good struggle. Everything you said is part of the work we're trying to do. And it's hard. It's hard. We need equivalency because we work with 5 assessment principles. One is the equity principle, which is assessment should be fair to all learners. Well, if it's going to be fair to all learners, then there must be different pathways. There must be different possibilities. There must be different potential artifacts. But also, if it's going to be fair to all learners, it can't be that a kid with great capacity to do brilliant work is not doing it because we've leveled things to a degree where it's just not challenging for that kid. As an aside, one of the great skills of great teachers is getting the level of challenge right, you know, the zone of proximal development. What is challenging to produce this set of artifacts might be, they might look brilliant, but they didn't require much from that particular learner. Something that looks to the uninformed eye less impressive might have been massively difficult for that kid who's on the autism spectrum. Some of my family are, and I see the struggles in schools. So I think that's the struggle, but I think it's absolutely doable if you sit the right people, the right kinds of people in the room with those questions, Benjamin, and say, okay, look, we've got a dilemma here because we want equity and we want alternative forms of assessment. We want the kids to provide evidence, but all of our kids are different. So what within what range will kids be able to choose their own methods of providing evidence? Within what range? And I think ranges are useful. And then taking into account that actual kid, just kind of an aside, but Thomas Gosky's a brilliant thinker about assessment. He talks about performance and progress and process. I think those three P's are a really interesting piece of thinking. What does the performance look like against some kind of recognizable standard, if you like, but also, and that would be the point arrived at, but what about the distance traveled as well? Because we have to recognize the progress of kids and then what process factors might have influenced their performance and their progress. And those could be internal factors or external factors. So I think we have a lot of things in the mix, but working on this kind of thing, and it is messy, and constructivism is messy, and that's honestly where all the good ideas come from. You get into that mess, you throw in, okay, what about performance? What about progress? What about process? What about individual freedom? But some sense that everybody did something that was at the utmost of their capacity. What's the range we can offer? We are doing that. That's our challenge. We're trying to do exactly what you described. But it is the good struggle, because to opt out of that struggle is to say, oh, screw it, it's too hard. Let's just do standardized testing. And what we do is we just fall back on that easy option, even though we know it's not preparing kids for what we actually want to do, is give them something they can use in the real world. So I really embrace the mess. I embrace the ambiguity. I embrace the puzzling. Because I tell you what, it pulls together some really bright people who love kids and love learning, who are damn well determined to come up with good answers to the dilemmas that you're putting forward, because those are the dilemmas. But you have to believe we can address them in a fair and reasonable way, because there's too many smart people now who believe this is a good direction. So I have great trust in the collective mind once you get good people in the room. Again, Jim Collins, good to great. Get the right people on the bus. We have a simple hedgehog principle. Get the right people on the bus. First who, then what. We will work out the what with people like yourself and Inga and others, because we believe in the why, Simon Sinek. It's the why that's driving us. I might not know all the hows and whats, but I'm sure we'll find them, because so many good people have been attracted to the why.
And I'm going to throw another layer here, something that I've been grappling with past little while, and it's come up recently, and I think this might be a good time to introduce it. You talk about the collective mind. I'll bring up maybe the extended mind, this idea that with the Industrial Revolution, the Scientific Revolution, we've separated, and this is nothing new, the head and heart, and made this kind of big difference between our cognitive and our feelings. And I love public presentations, and I love teaching or being a guide on when it comes to presenting. I find it that it's the one job, one thing, one skill that everyone, no matter who they are, has to have. Presentation skills, because any kind of social interaction is a form of presentation. And it's about influence in so many ways, communication is. But one of the things that I struggle with, that frustrates me, is oftentimes when I see these rubrics about public presentations is, do you have a certain amount of sources? Are you projecting your voice? Do you make eye contact? All of these skills. But I tell I tell the learners in the room, none of that actually matters. What matters is how much you move your audience. And when I show, which I do almost every time, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, or Amanda Gorman speaking, you know, telling her poetry, I feel the skill. I feel the power of their words and the way they deliver it. I don't need a rubric. I feel it in my body. How can we make room, or what would it take to make room for feeling as being one of the layers of assessment? Outside of our heads, inside of our heart, just knowing this is really good. And I bring this back to what you mentioned earlier about experts. As an expert, you feel if something is good as much as you know it is, because you've got those connections. Is there room for feeling in assessment?
We've actually designed a small black metal box that plugs in. It's called an emotionometer, and it does measure the amount of feeling in the room at any given time. So I'm going to go this from because I totally agree with you. When I work with students and we're trying to define what great teaching is like in any given school, I usually enter it through the world of feeling. So it goes like this. Here's the activity. I put kids in teams. They have a big sheet of chart paper. And I say, guys, I want you to finish this sentence in a single word. Or in fact, a set of words. Fill the page with words. But here's the sentence starter. I walk into a classroom at International School of Brussels where great learning is happening. I get a sense of, and I colon. And the kids fill the page with words. Excitement, engagement, emotion, humor, laughter, caring. And then I say, okay, so we know what great learning feels like, don't we? Now let's see what it looks like then. And I say, take five of your sense words, your feeling words, put them down the side of the page. For each one, what do you see the kids doing that makes you have that feeling? And what do you see the teachers doing? And then I share that with teachers and say, if you enter the world of quality learning and quality teaching through the feeling door, this is what comes out. Because I completely agree with that. I'm not a big rubric fan, if I can dare say that. I'm certainly not a fan of things like users' manuals for curriculum bodies. I suffer from, it's called MIGO officially, the acronym My Eyes Glaze Over. I'm just not very bothered. And the thing is, and the same with recruiting. I don't care if a person's, with due respect to your doctorate, I don't really care if someone has a doctorate, if I'm hiring an early childhood teacher or a high school physics teacher for that matter. What I care about is what it feels like when I talk to them. Do I want to work with this person? What does it feel like when I walk in their classroom? Holy crap, I don't care how clever this person. This is so dull. I mean, if you want to know what your teachers are like, shadow a kid for a day. I defy you not to fall asleep after lunch. I think feeling is tremendously important. It's I love music, and I've got one of the things that just arrived in our shipping after 8 years was about 1 million CDs. And I love storytelling music, Townes Van Zandt, Warren Zevon. So much is just your emotional response to the situation. And what kids remember from school is feeling, is when they felt something, when we won that football tournament, when I played in the band, when that teacher humiliated me. We do a great storytelling thing. We talked about story at the beginning. I say to teachers, I tell a couple of learning stories about my own childhood, one inspiring one, one humiliating one. And I ask people to remember a story from their own learning history and then draw that scenario and draw it with their non-dominant hand. And then turn that story, that picture, into a feeling word, and then turn that word into a message for colleagues. Dear teachers, from my story, we should always remember that we can destroy or inspire a kid with a single word. That it matters whether kids think we know them and like them, that, because I think one of the ways to bridge that knowing-doing gap, that weird parallel universe between what we say and what we do, is through feeling. One, I think, is through language. I think learning stories are more powerful than curriculum objectives, for example. And I think feeling and stories together begin to make people think, oh, that's what it feels like. Oh, that's what you want me to do in the classroom. It kind of looks like that. So a lot of the time, Benjamin, I think as we've been trying to, I don't even like the word, train teachers, we've gone at it from very cognitive, very dry, very academic language. But academia is not transferring into classrooms. I've been talking to a brilliant English researcher. I won't mention his name because he said to his colleagues recently, he told me the story. He said, guys, I'm going to shock everyone in the room. We're all university professors. I believe we could stop doing our research for the next 20 years and it wouldn't make any difference because nobody's using our stuff. I would say we go back to that gap, the knowing-doing gap, the parallel universes. One of the bridges, Benjamin, is feeling. The question then is, not to be almost contradictory or hypocritical, what are my strategies for evoking feeling? And the thing is, some of it is just pure, almost instinct, although it's not all instinct. People like Martin Luther King, they may not have had script writers, but I'm absolutely sure that he was lying awake at 2 a.m. puzzling about many, many things. And one of them was the words he was going to say and the way he was going to say them, seizing the moment, feeling that you're part of history, trying to create some kind of magic in the classroom. But it's back to what we said earlier. The impact is measured in feeling. The techniques may be outputs that you need, they may not. But in the end, you want people to walk out with a feeling. On this, all these are long rants, aren't they? But David Perkins once said to me, he said, to make transfer happen, you need three things. He said, you need sufficient knowledge to know what to do in any circumstance. You need to be able to spot the situation when it's needed or appropriate to use that knowledge, and you need to basically give a damn. Otherwise, the kids won't use what we've taught them. If they don't care enough, they won't use it. So I turn that, because I like alliteration, into we need the information, situation, and inclination. And the inclination is a feeling. Yeah, the kid could know exactly what to do when faced with a particular personal issue with a homeless person next to them or something. If they don't give a damn, nothing's going to happen. So they need to have enough information about the causes of homelessness. They need to find themselves in proximity and context with those kinds of situations. They need to care enough to make their knowledge into something they're actually going to do. And somehow that's why we go with conceptual competency, character, because if we don't have the character piece built in, forget the rest. So, yeah, I just think I wish we did have an emotionometer. But I think we can. I'm never afraid to go with things that aren't quantifiable. There are ways to observe and feel feelings. You can put a comment on that. You can put feedback on that. You can give feedback on that. If we go with the purpose principle from the work I'm doing with Jay, he says the purpose of assessment is to provide feedback to learners to improve their learning and feedback to teachers to inform our practice. I can absolutely give feedback to a team of kids to say, well, it was technically very good, but for me personally, it didn't move me. And here are some of the things I think might account for that. Like, it didn't appear to move you. So while it may not be quantifiable and then in that sense measurable, I think emotions are definitely, you can experience them. And if you can experience something, you can codify your feedback in a way. We use very simple feedback. We always just say two things. What worked well, even better if. Very nice, simple languages. Even better if I actually felt that you actually cared about what you were talking about. How would I know that? And then you'd get into, well, and you can't fake sincerity, you'd get into all that. But so another long rambling answer to say, to me, feeling inspires action, not academic cognitive understanding. You know, we all know what should happen in the world. Why don't we do it? We don't care enough. That's an emotion. So hence the three C's always spiraling together. We call it the triple helix, the DNA of learning. Our approach to a character doesn't sit aside. There's no character program. It's embedded in every learning module. It's the character element. So I guess I'm just saying that we've tried, Benjamin, to build the emotive, the personal into everything rather than some kind of afterthought, some kind of aside. Because if we don't feel it, we'll do nothing with it.
One last question about sustainability, and specifically how we might think about the learning experiences we design in ways that really care for the planet, care for each other, care for ourselves, recognizing that all three of these things are the same, are fractals of one another, are connections and different ways of drawing little circles around certain identities. Do you think that there might be space created, or that maybe schools or experts or might be really embracing this idea of values, not just of character, but also redirecting the purpose of schools towards more action around sustainability? And I don't just mean like solar panels and recycling bins. I mean real connection of care and relationships for the good of the planet, not as necessarily just as citizens, but also as kin with non-human or more than human forms of life. Do you think that it's possible that we might rethink some of these actions that we have to broaden out character, to really think about the connections that we have with the more than human world?
Oh, 100%. Just as a quick aside, I'm a very, very passionate wildlife photographer. I have been for 40 years. When I'm not doing this kind of work, which I love to do, I can see my 600 millimeter lens from here. I'm in the Panamanian rainforest with birds and snakes and bugs. I think we have to make it curriculum, Benjamin. It's like character. You can't have a curriculum. Oh, we do Common Core. We have a character program. It doesn't work. So we've organized all human learning around what we call six human commonalities: purpose and balance, stories and signals. One of them is sustainability and systems. Each one of those content organizers give rise to one of the things in our portrait. So we're saying a school lifetime of looking at the patterns and principles of things is going to help create a rational problem solver. So there's a linear connection between the portrait, the human commonalities, the content. So I think we have to make all these things the actual content of the curriculum that we assess to. And I like the way you think about it, because it's too easy for it to be recycled, reused, et cetera. Here's one thing that we've been teaching and learning in a module in Honduras called What Did the Mayans Ever Do For Us? Based actually on Life of Brian, What Did the Romans Ever Do For Us? Sketch. And we looked at the Mayan civilization in Honduras, and the kids went to Copan, this wonderful Mayan site, just a beautiful, inspiring place. One of the things that came out was the similarities in the factors associated with the fall of civilization. And there are two that emerge. One is socioeconomic stratification, and one is environmental degradation. Those two factors have been constant in most of these disappearances of apparently dominant civilizations. So when you talk about care for ourselves, care for each other, we look at sustainability of social systems, not just natural ecosystems, because right now, and we could have 20 podcasts about the reasons, the polarities in society, the way social media promote hate, because hate promotes scrolling and scrolling promotes profit. We have tremendous social divisions. So we have social structures that are breaking apart and are no longer sustainable unless we change. And we have the physical planet, which is breaking apart and is no longer sustainable. So I think we have to make it curriculum. Ollie Lovell has just put out some work on student behaviors, if you like, and said it's learning, it's curriculum. Sustainability is curriculum. It's not a project. It's not. So we start in early childhood. We have an economics module written, co-written by my wife and I for kindergarten. It's called Who's Got All the Yellow Crayons? We put the kids in teams. We ask them to draw a picture of themselves on Honduran Independence Day. And in that school, in EIS in San Pedro, they would all be wearing their yellow T-shirts. We put all the yellow crayons on one table so the other kids couldn't get them. And then we had to work out with five-year-olds, hey, they've got all the yellow crayons, we all need them. What can we do? Can we steal their crayons? Can we trade red? Can we trade for crayons? In which case, is a yellow crayon now worth more than a red crayon? Can we work out ways to share them? So we start the debate on fairness and resources. And what do you do if you don't have what you need to achieve your life's goals, but somebody else has all of them? So I would say it must be curriculum, that it's not just, even though I love the rainforest and I spend my time in it, it's really social ecosystems as well as the natural ecosystems. We got to start with them as soon as we get them, as toddlers. And it's not, I have this debate with my daughter who's very radical in her thinking. The job is not an alternative indoctrination. The job is education. It's giving the kids the knowledge, information, and the tools to make their own minds up, but make sure they have access to whatever we can call the truth. That's another slippery concept these days. So again, for me, it's all curriculum. It's described in our poetry. It's framed in our curriculum. We have lots of modules about it. And I just think every year we need to spend time pointing out that societies are falling apart all over the world. Not to over-dramatize it, because wonderful things are happening around the world as well. And that's what school is for. Now, try doing an SAT on that. It's a very good illustration of why we need alternative forms of assessment, where kids have to provide their own evidence, taking into everything you said into account about how hard that is to let them have voice and choice, but somehow recognize there's some quality indicators in there somewhere. So I guess to sum up, I'd say the things we value need to become our transfer goals, and they need to inform our curriculum. And it's time to do that. Now, we can't keep going into work every day and doing things we don't believe in, and then wondering why teachers leave the profession and kids are disengaged and try to break the testing system with AI because they don't believe in it. There are no actual mysteries here, Benjamin. There are no mysteries. It's all quite clear. The only question is, shall we do it then? Shall we actually do what we know we can do now? So again, I so agree with the things you've been saying. All I've been trying to do is turn those values, those questions, those ideas into a workable, scalable, transferable learning system with space in it. That system doesn't mean cloning.
Listen, Kevin, I really appreciate your time and all the insights and actually the simplicity that you bring about to some very complex questions. And I mean that, you know, with the greatest of compliments of the ease of which you bring to the table, again, some very complex, but now they feel kind of understandable and digestible points. So thank you.
Well, that's what I try to do, is make the complex clear. I'll finish up with that. Just one thought about that, because I've been doing this for a long time. I think it's Pascal who's supposed to have said to a friend, apologies. If I'd had more time, I'd have written a shorter letter. So you spend 40 years, you end up trying to write a shorter letter. So final thought, and thanks for the opportunity. Really enjoyable conversation, Benjamin. Thanks for having me.
This has been the Coconut Thinking Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. www.coconut-thinking.com is our website. You can find articles there, links to podcasts, interviews, resources. Again, that's www.coconut-thinking.com. And in the meantime, subscribe, leave us 5 stars, tell your friends, and we hope to hear from you soon. Bye-bye.